My name is Erica Ariel Fox. Thank you all for coming. I have been studying and teaching negotiation and leadership for about the last 20 years. I graduated in 1995 from Harvard Law School, and I began teaching there in 1996. So I've been there for a while. I know it's hard to imagine that I graduated so long ago, but I did. And what I want to share with you is what I think really is the next frontier in terms of this field of negotiation and leadership, which is not about how to negotiate with other people, but how to negotiate with yourself. And the premise that I want to explore with you is the idea that you really need to know how to negotiate with yourself first in order to deal successfully with other people. So we're going to look at the phenomenon of inner conflict, the tug of war that many of us experience between different voices inside of ourselves. I'm calling those voices inner negotiators, because in a lot of ways they are. And it turns out that the best practices for actual across-the-table negotiation, shockingly many of them apply to the negotiation within. So my hope is to leave you at the end of the hour with a little map that you can use as you reflect on your own inner negotiators, and I'll give you some very small exercises that you can do if you want to stretch your own capacity in this area. So quick question, how many people here have ever negotiated with a customer or client? How many of you have ever negotiated with a colleague? With someone in your house that you live with? Yes, with someone under 10 years old. Ah, yes. So I have been working in many different environments, as I mentioned, for a long time, working with leaders of governments, working with leaders of companies. But I have not ever learned how to negotiate with a six-year-old, which is very problematic because I now have a six-year-old in my life because I got married 2 years ago. And I married someone who has a little son from his first marriage. So despite my vast training in this area, it turns out nothing applies. Now, I want to say just between us friends that in my particular case, my stepson doesn't speak a word of English. So that does make my situation more challenging. So any of the rest of you who are stepmothers, I just want to say, you know, I'm in this with you, but my situation is worse. Are there any stepmoms out there or anyone who had a stepmom or any stepparents? Okay, so you can just have a special understanding of the situation. So when I moved in with my husband, his son, my stepson, was coming into our room pretty early in the morning, which, as having been a single adult for a long time, wasn't something that I was used to. And then it turned out that he started coming in earlier and earlier, like every day. So it was 6:30 in the morning, then it was 6 in the morning, then it was like slipping back towards the 5:30, and I started freaking out because I'm a busy person and I need my sleep. So I expressed this to my husband, and he found a light that is attached to a clock. You're nodding because you have this clock. When the clock says 7 a.m., the light goes on. Do you see where this is going? So my husband explained to our little guy, when the light is on, then it's 7 o'clock and you can come into our room. When the light is not on, then it is not yet 7 o'clock and you should not come into our room. So do we understand each other? You know, do we have an agreement? They shook on it. That was like, problem solved. So next morning, 5:30 a.m., he comes in, you hear his little feet, you know, and he's like shaking my husband who's half asleep, and he turns and says, what is it, buddy? It's 5:30, I just want you to know. And he whispers in this little voice, that light, it's broken. That is a true story. And it was at that moment that I knew None of what I'm about to tell you will help you in any way with anyone who is first grade or earlier. However, I'm hoping that what I am going to share with you is information that you can use in most other areas of your life. So just a quick context about what we're talking about. Again, for those of you coming in, my background is at the Program on Negotiation at Harvard Law School. And in that institution, we don't think of negotiation only as the formal times you're making a deal, like the time you're buying a car or when you're trying to sell your home. We also don't limit the idea to big companies sitting around a conference room table doing a big merger, or even diplomats trying to reach a peace treaty. We think of negotiation to mean every moment of every day when I am trying to influence you or you are trying to influence me, we're negotiating. So that's why I asked you to think of how often in your own life, which is really from the time you wake up in the morning, you have people at home, you're trying to reach agreements, you are trying to allocate tasks. By the time you get to work or you're dealing with professional contacts, again, you may be negotiating formal contracts, but you may just be trying to figure out who's going to do what. Can we extend the deadline? Are we going to work within this budget? People are constantly trying to reach decisions together, set policy together, and resolve conflicts together. All of those involve negotiation. So a word about the history or the background to the book that I've written and that I'm going to talk to you about today. How many people have ever heard or read this book, Getting to Yes? So this is a very well-known book. It came out about 30 years ago. It was written by a teacher and mentor of mine. It's very well known for introducing the idea of win-win negotiation. And one of Roger Fisher's core principles was the idea that you should separate people from the problem. So if I'm having a problem with you, right, it might feel really personal. And that could be true if we were two human beings, or it could be true if we were two countries and our armies were killing each other. And Roger's advice was, it's not about this. It's not we're against each other as adversaries. We have a shared problem. And even if we're engaged in armed conflict, we can step to each other's side and face the problem together to try to resolve it. This school of thought is also often described as joint problem solving. So that shift from adversarial competitive negotiation to more collaborative or so-called win-win negotiation was really the main contribution of this book. This is a very good idea, but in sharing this idea in companies, with schools, nonprofits, in many different settings, people continue to say to us, I understand the theory of separating the people from the problem, but in my case, the people are the problem. So I can't separate them because my boss is actually insane and she is actually my problem. My teenager is so difficult, my direct reports have no accountability. I can't separate the people because the people are my problem. So this book, Difficult Conversations, and other books that came out around the same time, Crucial Conversations, Fierce Conversations, that whole genre of books, and I show you this one because it came from the same institution where I teach. Those books were trying to say, here's the best advice we have today on what to do when the people are the problem. For just relationship and communication building, for trying to generate trust and goodwill, this was, at that time, the best advice around for what to do when the people are the problem. But around this time, I continued to sense that we were missing an important piece of the puzzle. All of these models still fundamentally, thank you, all of these models fundamentally address what to do across the table, right? When someone is being difficult or you have a serious problem that you're trying to solve. And I had an insight in doing an exercise. It was in an executive education course. and it was an advanced course. So the ratio was one facilitator with three participants. So it would be like any of the three of you and me, we would have the day to work together. Each person was invited to bring a real negotiation challenge that was happening in their lives, and I was supposed to be their coach and give them tips and help them practice how to resolve the current challenge. So the night before I'm running this exercise, I am told that one member of my triad is a justice of the Supreme Court. That is what I thought. I also had graduated from law school like 5 minutes before, so I was 26 years old. And I thought, yes, I have a vast amount of experience to draw on to support this person. What could I do? He was in my group. He was not a U.S. justice, by the way. He was a high court justice in another country. But I, you know, tried to prepare myself, probably put on a little extra makeup or something to make myself feel better. When I went into the exercise in the morning, I asked him respectfully, you know, what was the challenge that he had chosen for the exercise? And he said, I want my wife to stop picking out my ties. And I said, I'm sorry? He said, every day for 50 years, I come out of the washroom and my whole outfit is laid out on the bed. I hate that. Why does she do that? So I asked him the question that probably many of you might be tempted to ask. Have you ever asked her not to do that? That is my problem. I cannot bring myself to ask my wife to stop picking out my tie every day. 50 years. So here was my problem as a negotiation coach. This is not a person who has issues with assertiveness, right? In my fantasy, he like sentences people to death from the bench. He's one of the most powerful people in his society. What am I going to have him do? Would you like to practice saying, please don't pick out my tie? Or would you like to practice saying, I would prefer that you not choose my tie anymore? And this is like ridiculous. It's ridiculous because he well knows what he could say. The problem is that he can't say it. He's getting in his own way. It's not because he doesn't know the words. It's what is getting in his way from saying or not saying, doing or not doing what he knows he could do. And that, for me, became an incredibly interesting question. So we started with separate the people from the problem. We evolved over 10 or 15 years to exploring what about when the people are the problem. And my book, Winning from Within, and the ideas I'm talking to you about today are really looking at the question, what if I am the problem? His wife is not his problem, right? Something is going on inside of him. So instead of practicing across the table, we said, okay, let's have one chair here for the part of you that actually does want to ask her to stop. But rather than practice lines, we're going to have another chair for the other negotiator in you who is telling you not to say it. See what I mean? That is the negotiation that has to happen. Because if we practice all the things he could say, at the moment, this negotiator is taking the day, right? Whatever that voice is saying, you know, you're so selfish, that's so mean and ungrateful, you know, you had 2 or 3 decades to raise it at this point, you know, it's a little late now to bring this up. Whatever this voice is telling him, it's telling him not to say anything. So until these inner negotiators reach an agreement where he can say something that asserts his preference, but in a loving enough way that both of these sides feel comfortable, he's not going to change that interaction. So what I've become really interested in is this gap, what I call the performance gap. And I think everyone in this room has experienced it at some point. You know what good behavior looks like, but you do something else. Right? You want to say something, you object to what's happening at the table in the conversation, but then at bedtime you lay awake asking, why didn't I say anything? Why did I just sit there? I didn't say anything. Or you think, okay, at this team meeting, I'm just going to be quiet, I'm going to listen, I'm going to ask questions, and then at some point in the meeting you said to yourself, I think I'm yelling. I think this is interrupting in a belligerent way. I'm not listening at all. And you have to go through, what happened? I went in with all the right intents and I knew what I was going to do. What happened? The issue is not that you don't know what to do and say. The question is, what part of you is standing up and telling you not to do it? Or to do something that you later regret? So my theory is the way to close this gap between what you want to do and want to say in the moment and what all of us experience, some kind of a gap between that and what we actually end up doing and saying, is to learn to negotiate with ourselves first. To have a map of the inner negotiators so that you can be choiceful and reach agreement inside of yourself, it makes everything else much easier. I want to pause and ask you to think for yourself of an example in your life. It could have been 10 years ago or this morning. It could have been in an email, in a meeting, on the phone, over Skype, in a text, or lo and behold, face to face with a live human being, where you either did say something that you later regretted and thought, even as the words came out of my mouth, I knew I shouldn't do it. Or you really didn't say or ask or do what a part of you really wanted to do, and you sat later and thought, I still regret that I didn't say or didn't do X, Y, Z. So see if you can think by yourself for a moment. Can you think of an example of a performance gap in your life? And it could be a recurring one that happens a lot. How many people can think of an example? Okay, great. So for 2 minutes, would you turn to someone next to you? Hopefully one of you has an example. And just share the example that you thought of. Could be someone behind you or in front of you also. Okay, one more minute. So, we're sort of been talking about the problem. Let's start moving into a map of what you can do about this. So we've been talking, in essence, about the voices inside of our head, right? Do you guys know that Rihanna and Eminem have a new song? I'm actually too old to know that, but someone told me that. You're young enough to actually know that. But anyway, it's called Monster. Is that right? And they're singing about the voices in their heads. It's really kind of cool. So this is based on a similar idea. As you can tell in the example with the judge, we have voices in our heads. What's important to know is that they don't all tell us the same things. They actually have different preferences, different styles, different values. It really is like having a little team inside your head. You have a voice that is about what you want. A voice that is thinking, thoughts, analyzing, assessing information. A part of you that feels. And a different part of you that gets very excited when you cross things off your to-do list. These are not in any way exhaustive of the voices, but what I have found is focusing on these four gives people a lot of tools to start becoming more aware and more choiceful. So I think of these four like having an inner top team. The part of you that wants, that dreams, is like an inner CEO. Your CEO cares about possibilities, the future, and is fueled by imagination and intuition. The thinker in you is like an inner CFO, who is not about fantastic possibilities, but perspective, looking at the facts, looking at numbers, measuring, evaluating. Not better or worse, but different, fueled by logic or rationality. You also have an inner VP of HR, or chief human resources officer, focusing on people, valuing relationships and communication, or the quality of trust, employee engagement. And finally, an inner COO, which is focused on performance, about getting it done, meeting deadlines. The COO in you, as we'll talk about in a minute, is not only focused on taking action, but also sometimes telling the hard truth. Because sometimes it involves saying no or setting limits. But these big four, what I call the big four, are actually much, much deeper in human nature than professional titles. I spent 10 years looking at a huge array of systems across centuries of time, across geographies of space, at a time when people in different parts of the earth could not have gone on Google to see how each other were thinking about human nature. Time and again, over and over, these four are articulated in different societies, in different languages. Sometimes they're referred to by the elements, fire, earth, air, and water. They're thought of as north, south, east, and west. There are many, many names for these, but time and again, the essential human condition is described as having a dreamer, a thinker, a lover, and a warrior. These symbols. I brought you some examples just to help put a little bit of a face to these qualities. I think these women represent dreamers. Oprah always inviting us to, you know, live our best life. Arianna Huffington, a different kind of dreamer, an entrepreneur, a business visionary. These women, to me, represent thinkers, the thinker quality. Christiane Amanpour doing investigative reporting. Susie Orman taking complex ideas about personal finance and just thinking very clearly about them and explaining them in ways all of us can understand. Two of my favorite lover icons. I pick Angelina and Michelle because although they are both so capable and so strong and are both so competent at getting things done in the world, they over and over actually affirm the centrality of loving their families, of loving their children, of loving all children, of loving refugee children, of loving children who are obese and wanting them to get fit and save their lives. These are very strong women who over and over take a stand also for the love they feel in their marriage. And there's sort of a love of humanity, a love of people in these women. So that's why I chose them. This is Malala, known to many of us, and Sheryl Sandberg. Again, just very different images of the warrior quality in us. The warrior is a part of us that can take a stand, that can speak her mind, hold her ground, tell the hard truth. And these are just examples. But I would caution about these examples that I'm giving them to you to portray one particular part of the Big Four. But it's not because I want to suggest these people are strong dreamers, these people are the thinkers, these are the lovers. Every one of us and every one of them have all of the Big Four as potential. Probably some of them we express more, and some of them we express less. But it's not true that you are a thinker, and therefore you're not a warrior. Everyone has all of the Big Four inside of them. How many people have ever heard of this story? Yes? Okay, so I'll tell you why I want to share this story. As I had mentioned, I did a lot of research across different cultures, and I found many, many stories, myths, folk tales, fairy tales, parables that tell over and over about the journey to explore the Big Four inside of ourselves. And this is just, at least in the United States, a fairly well-known story. So I want to use it just to illustrate the universal nature of this dynamic with the Big Four. So we all know that these characters are going together down the yellow brick road. But look at who we have here. We have the Scarecrow. Scarecrow's issue is what? The Scarecrow thinks he has a whole head of straw, right? He thinks he has no brain. In other words, he's lost his thinker. And he wants to go see the wizard so he can get his brain back, so he can have thoughts and feel smart. Then we have the Tin Man. He pounds on his chest and he said, there's just nothing. What is he looking for? He's looking for his heart. The Tin Man represents losing touch with the lover within. He can't feel, he can't cry, he can't connect to people. He's all rusty. Because it was so long ago, right, that he had any feeling. And then he was just stuck. So he thinks his lover is lost. He is going to go down the yellow brick road to try to find it. We have a lion. But this is a cowardly lion. This is a lion who has lost his courage. So even though he should be king of the forest, because he's a cowardly lion, he's afraid of his own shadow. So he's going down the yellow brick road because he feels, essentially, he's lost his inner warrior. He doesn't have courage, can't fight, he's too afraid. And he believes because his warrior is lost, if he goes to the wizard, he's going to get it back. Are we together so far? There's one more character going down the yellow brick road. Obviously, that is Dorothy. Dorothy is the dreamer. Right? Somewhere over the rainbow, there's a land that I dream of, right? And in this place, dreams really do come true. She's not there. She dreams of being at a place where her dreams can come true. And what is Dorothy's dream? She wants to go home, right? All she wants is to get home, but she cannot figure out how to do it. So she is a dreamer who can't go after her dream. She doesn't know how to go after her dream, but if she gets to the wizard, she's convinced that he will show her the way home. So there are a few lessons, right, that we learn at the end of this story. Here's one that I think is really interesting. This is obviously only my interpretation. This is not a fact, or it certainly doesn't represent any historical interpretation by the creators of the film. What do you notice about the creatures and the people who are going down the yellow brick road? How many people and how many creatures? Thank you, Toto fans. There's always a Toto fan. Yes, there are five. If you count Toto, there's only one person. What'd you say? And she's a woman, yes. There is one young woman going down the yellow brick road. Why do you think that is significant? Why might it be significant? I think it's quite interesting if we imagine these are not four distinct characters. These are all parts of Dorothy. You have this woman who believes she has lost her thinker, she has lost touch with her lover, she cannot access her warrior, and she cannot figure out how to pursue her dreams. She is out of touch with every one of the most fundamental elements of her nature. And she is going on a journey to try to find them again, to embrace them again, to integrate them again. And when she does that, when she goes through her journey and she picks up all these different parts of herself, what happens when she gets to the wizard? Does he actually give her all of these things? No. He merely points out they were always there all along. You never lost them, right? You never didn't have a brain or didn't have a heart. You never didn't have courage or know how to make your dream come true. Basically, you just forgot that it was there all along. No one in this room has to go out on a journey or do therapy for 20 years or go to an ashram or do anything else to get these parts of yourself. They are in there right now, today. You're not using all of them. You're not using all of them to the same extent. But you don't have to go find someone like the wizard who can give them to you. The process is really about noticing you can't ever not have them. You cannot use them. But you have all of the big four in you. I'll tell you one reason that I know that. Because we live in a very unique time in history when neuroscientists can show us the functioning of our brain. And it turns out that we have four parts of our brain. We have a left side and a right side, and then we have a front and a back. So we have the left and the right side in the front and the right and left side in the back. It turns out that these four different parts of our brain correlate precisely to the big four aspects of human nature. That's unbelievable. So for centuries and centuries, people have been writing about this, philosophers, poets, theologians, psychologists, anthropologists. But these were theories, social science theories. Today, we can look at an fMRI and say, actually, the human brain is precisely designed to function in those four ways. So if you have a brain, which we do, all of us, you have the capacity for every one of the big four right now. What I find interesting in working with professionals all over the world is very, very few people actually do use them all. Very few. So I talk about this as figuring out your current big four profile. And what I mean by that is, are there one or two of these parts of you that you use a lot? Maybe you're very good at them. And are there one or two that you stopped using a very long time ago, possibly for good reason, or you just think that's just not me, that's just not part of who I am? I did a workshop once, and I had a gentleman from NASA in the program, and he came up to me on a break, and he said, you know what, I'm not arguing with your theory, I'm just letting you know, I don't actually have any feelings. I just don't have any. And I said, really? He said, yeah. I mean, it's not that I'm against feelings. I just don't actually have any. So I asked him, are you married? And he said, yes, very proudly. Yes, for 28 years. So I asked, well, if you have no feelings, how did you know that you wanted to propose? And he just got this really cute look in his face, and he said, oh, that's easy, because this was the girl of my dreams, and I knew I would go crazy if I couldn't be with her. And I thought, yeah, look in that experience for a feeling. It's in there. It's in there. People say to me all the time, you know, oh, I could never tell that to that person. You know, if I might say, you know what, I think maybe you want to give this feedback to this person. They say, oh, no, I couldn't do that because it would be so mean. Warrior skills are often the most loving skills you have. And I'll give you a quick example of this. I was working a long time ago with a group of people who had a very rigorous system for people getting elected to become partner. So if you became a vice president in this company, there was a committee that was formed. They collected all sorts of information, and then the committee would vote on whether or not you were elected to partner. And you had three chances. So after 3 years, if the committee voted three times not to elect you, then you had to leave the firm. So I was working with a vice president at that time who was really excited. The group had decided to form a committee. They gathered all the data. They had the discussion and voted. He was not elected. But that was okay. And he sort of, you know, set himself very aggressive targets for performance for the following year. Thought maybe I'm not showing that I can bring in new clients. He worked really hard at networking and trying to bring in new work. Year went by. They formed a committee. They voted. He was not elected. So now he was really stressed and really went into high gear because he's got one shot left. The entire rest of the year, he didn't see his family. He never took a vacation. He worked all the time because he just wanted to make sure it would all work out. Third time, form a committee, not elected. And he was quite devastated by that, particularly because some of the people on the committee voting were friends of his, colleagues of his. So he asked me to mediate a conversation between himself and one of the partners on the committee, because he wanted to reach some kind of closure and understand what had happened. So in this meeting, I'm sitting there and I have the two of them, and he looks this guy in the eye and he says, I want to know, the first time that my case was brought before the committee, did you know then that I was never going to get elected? And his colleague looked at him straight in the eye and straight in the face, and he said, yes. So this guy, you know, like took a deep breath and he said to his colleague, then for God's sake, why didn't you tell me? And his partner said, I didn't want to hurt you. I didn't want to hurt you. I couldn't imagine saying to you, you know what, it's not just that you didn't get elected, you're never going to get elected. So really, you should do something else. I just couldn't say it. That person spent two more years of his life trying to prove his value to a company that was never going to elect him as a partner because his colleagues thought it wasn't nice to say something mean like the truth, which is, you're never going to get elected at this company. So if you have it in your head that the warrior who tells the hard truth is a bad guy, you will keep yourself from saying some hard things. Here's another one that is really hard to say. I don't want to be in this relationship anymore. That's a really hard one to say. How many of us have ever been in a relationship for between 1, 2, 5, 10, 20, or 100 years, longer than we wanted to, because we didn't want to say, I don't want to be in this relationship anymore? Sometimes the hard truth is what's needed. That's what the warrior does for you. So again, I want to pause for just a minute and ask each of you as you look at this profile, is there any part of this where you say, yep, I'm pretty good at that, I'm pretty strong at that, but this one area, I don't know, I think that actually I could do some development there. And let me say why this matters. It matters because in your life, at home and at work, You want to be capable. You want to be competent. Different skills, life skills, leadership skills, belong to each of the big four. So the skills that belong to one of the big four that you have in exile, it will be quite difficult for you to perform those skills well. Ever try to get empathy from someone who's really attached to their thinker? If you did, you'd be cringing inside. It's not because they're bad people. But empathy lives in the lover. And if you have an intellectual, even best-intended intellectual in the world, who's trying to support you by solving your problem, it's not that they wouldn't like to listen, it's that if they're not connected to the inner lover circuitry, they're going to find it very difficult to do well. And the same would be true for us. So what I want to do, I want to share one more idea with you, and then give you a quick exercise, one little exercise for each of the big four, in case you would enjoy trying to practice or stretch a little bit with this, and then just take a couple of questions. So even though we just spent all this time talking about the big four, I do want to say, truth in advertising, we are also much more than the big four. So the big four are very primary drivers of how we behave and interact in the world, and we also have a core, a center, what I'm calling the center of well-being, which is much deeper to all of us than our thoughts, our emotions, our dreams, or our impulses to act. And one of the ways that you get skilled at managing this internal negotiation is figuring out ways when you're really attached to your thinker or really attached to your warrior. If you can step to your own center, which is like being in neutral, it gives you some space to see the big picture and make a wiser choice. A way to think about this would be if you're driving a stick shift car, it's very difficult if you're trying to go from one gear straight to the other without going through neutral. But if you go from one gear into neutral, you can really go almost anywhere once you get yourself to neutral. It's like that with us too. It's very difficult. If you're in work mode, I had this conversation yesterday. If I'm in work mode and then I call my husband and he says, I'm trying to connect, but I feel like you're not there. I'm like, you're right, I'm not. I'm trying to answer my email. I can't go from warrior space into heart space on a dime. I just can't do it. What I could have done is taken a 2-minute break before calling him, putting my email away and just saying, oh, I'm going to try to remind myself what I love about my husband before calling him. Get back into neutral rather than expecting ourselves to shift on a dime from one into the next. So here are a couple of quick exercises, and then we'll take one or two questions. Dreamer. If you want to work on your dreamer, I would suggest giving yourself a little bit of time to muse on yourself in the future. Picture yourself feeling happy, feeling fulfilled, productive, at ease, however you might like to imagine yourself in the future, feeling passionate. And without thinking about all the reasons why this picture cannot happen, just call that picture to mind, or write it down, or draw the picture. And you'll notice these voices coming in, like, well, yes, that would all be great, but you can't afford that, so there's really no point in, you know, this is why your dreamer doesn't actually get to express herself, because she gets whacked too quickly by these other voices. Well, yes, if you got a divorce and didn't have any children, you could do that. The dreamer doesn't have to be realistic. That's not her strength. You've got all these other voices to help you make a plan at the right time that it can be done in the constraints of your life. The dreamer is about possibility, infinite potential. So just muse on yourself in the future, your organization, your family, the country, whatever you want, and imagine, I see myself in the future, happy, fulfilled, passionate, productive. What is in this picture? Where am I living? What am I wearing? What do I see myself doing? Who am I with? What do I do every day? Just see what happens. thinker. If you feel that you underuse your thinker, there's two things that I think can be helpful. One is pick one issue that you feel is a topic people are talking about around you. Recently, people have been talking about the government shutdown, for example. People are talking about healthcare and the website and the whole system and whether it's working or not working or ever should have been working. Pick an issue people are talking about at your company, in your team, in your family, where you might sit into a conversation and not participate. Because you'd be thinking, I just don't feel I'm informed enough about that issue to even have an opinion. Or like, I just don't know enough about that to know if I agree or not, so I'm going to just sit quietly. And make a decision to learn about it so you can participate in that discussion. Just go on Google, read some articles, read some editorials, talk to some people around you so that when that conversation comes up, you can at least participate, you can understand what's going on, and you could say, you know, respectfully, I think I see it differently. I have a different view. Don't let yourself off the hook by just saying, well, I don't read the news, so I'll just sort of tune out right now. Because that's what your thinker does. For the lover, if you want to work on this, I think a way to do it is to pick one relationship in your life, just one. And say, for the next week or two, I just want to deepen the connection and trust in that relationship. So it could be just a brand new person at your office, and you might feel, I just don't have any relationship with this person, I don't know her. It could be, I had a real breakdown of trust with that person, and I really would like to try to repair that. But just one situation where you can say, I'm going to make some effort to build a sense of connection, to build a sense of trust or goodwill with that person, and see what happens. It could be, by the way, as simple as, every time I get emails from my sister, I think to myself, I will answer that later. But for the next week, when I get emails from my sister, I'm just going to answer them right away. Just answer them. Change your behavior in the relationship. Warrior. I would invite you to think of a conversation that you are not having, that you are avoiding, and imagine trying to have it. And if you're not motivated, ask yourself, what is it costing me or this other person or our team or our company or our family? What is the cost that I am avoiding rather than having this conversation? Because if your warrior is keeping quiet, it's often because your warrior is thinking of all the terrible things that could go wrong if you do have the conversation. The problem is your warrior is not focusing on all the things that are going wrong right now because you are not having the conversation. Right? Situation's not getting better. It may well be getting worse. You're not addressing it. And all sorts of other things that are going wrong. Maybe it impacts your leadership and your reputation as everyone in the business unit is saying, why does she never have this conversation? Why doesn't she address this person who's not pulling their weight or whatever? There are a lot of costs to avoiding important conversations. So with this one in particular, I would say, please don't pick the single most haunting, unfulfilled conversation that you've wanted to have, but you've never had it. It may be a good thing to have that conversation, but not for your warrior practice. Your warrior practice should be with a very low-risk situation where if it doesn't go that well, you can say, well, that was not perfect, but at least I tried, and, you know, it's a start. And have important conversations that have so far gone unexpressed when you've got a little bit more experience under your feet. So this is what I wanted to just share with you in closing. This is a picture of the Avon Walk for Breast Cancer. I don't know if any of you have ever done this walk. I just signed up for it. And I find this very inspiring because in order to participate in this walk, you actually need to call on all of the big four. You have to somehow connect to the dream of a world without breast cancer or a world of early detection where people can be cured quickly. You have to really feel that dream in an inspiring way. You also have to care about and believe in scientific research because they're raising money to do experiments and to do research to find information to advance treatment and prevention. You really have to care about people. Maybe you are doing the walk for yourself because you are a survivor and it is an act of self-honoring and self-love. Maybe you're walking in honor of someone else. Maybe you and a group of friends are walking out of a sense of sisterhood and love for women and wanting them to be healthy and live long lives. But there's a very strong community component to an effort like this. And finally, you got to walk 40 miles in 2 days. Woo! So that's the warrior who says, you know what? I'm going to do it. I'm going to practice and train and get ready. And when the day comes, I'm going to keep on going until we cross that finish line. Because that's what the warrior is about. Determination, seeing it through. So what I love about this is, to me, it reinforces again the idea that it's not that you are a thinker or you are a lover. It's that we all have these capacities. We can draw on all of them, all at the same time or at the right time for the right reasons. And really my wish for all of you, for myself, for all of our women, colleagues, mothers, daughters, sisters who are not in this room, that we really take seriously the idea of our own wholeness, of our own incredible unfulfilled potential, of the invitation that life is offering us to use all of the gifts that we've been given in order to make a difference. So that is my whirlwind tour of winning from within for you guys. I want to see if there are one or two questions or comments, and then I am going downstairs to join the 4 o'clock book signing, which is down in the exhibit hall in, yes, many miles away from here. Don't wear your shoes, but it's, I think, room 1 and 2 of the exhibit hall. It's sort of towards the back. Probably by now many of you have seen where the books are. So any questions, 1 or 2 comments or questions? Yes, please use the mic so folks can hear you.
Hi, thank you for being here with us and sharing that with us. My question is, how did you choose your career at Harvard Law? And what was the biggest self-negotiator within these big four that you had to deal with during this
decision? What was the second part? I just didn't hear it.
Yep. What was the biggest self-negotiator within these big four that you had to deal with when choosing your career at Harvard Law?
Those are really interesting questions. When I was in university, I thought I wanted to run for elected office. I don't think that anymore. But I thought that at the time, so I thought a law degree would be helpful. I spent my summers in law school in Washington, D.C., because I still had that same vision for myself, and it was so brutal. It was so clear to me how brutal politicians are to each other, and the personal attacks and, like, horrible things that politicians say about each other, and I was trying to imagine myself having a life and a family and a personal life, and I just thought, it just seems like a toxic environment for a life. So then I was stuck at the law school with no political aspirations. And I found my way to this conflict resolution center at the school, which was a haven for me, because it was a group of people who really wanted to change the world, but not in that way, and who care a lot about resolving conflict. And I think I would say that the biggest thing that's been hard for me is, because I care a lot about influencing mainstream corporate business, although I have a very strong lover and dreamer, those environments often don't. And part of my dream is to bring ideas that are usually marginalized to personal growth and self-help and psychology and translate them into business language that business people and businessmen can comfortably use and learn, and that is, you know, what I'm doing. But as a result of that, my own inner lover is often, you know, a little bit left in the cold, and it's been a journey for me to figure out how to take care of myself while fulfilling my own personal sense of mission. I don't know if that answers the question. Yes?
Hi. I was wondering, how do external factors influence your internal negotiators?
Oh, they don't. No. they do, but a lot less than we think. A lot less than we think. There are many, many teachings and teachers who will say, our life is much less defined by what happens to us than what we do with and how we experience what happens to us. So that is not in any way to minimize the real impact of hard things. Everyone in this room and everyone we know has experienced genuinely hard things that life has put in their path. And yet, I would say, I actually, at this moment in my life, do believe that it is not as much what happens to us as what we do with it. Yes.
Okay, so I don't have a question, but I just wanted to just kind of, I guess, an observation that I'm a lobbyist, and I've been one for a decade now, and desperately looking for to find something else to do. So congratulations on following your instincts.
And I would have to say, you having come here today was you following an instinct. So I encourage you to keep following it.
Thank you.
So with that, guys, I'm going to close. I welcome you to come downstairs, and thank you so much for coming.